Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on KHOI Radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I am Donna Priskintas. I want to slide a little comment in here, Lana.
Oh, yes.
I want you guys to know that Lana does this introduction a cappella every time, and she's always right on key. It's not like it's got a canned little thing that we play. She just does it.
Well, that's because I'm my own key. It's a good, easy way to start. So here we are, Donalana Kitchen. Today on the Donalana Kitchen, we'll talk about refreshing cold summer soups and clafouti. Now, if you don't know what a clafouti is, stick around. Also, we'll talk about ground cherries and some kitchen questions will be answered by Donna. And also, we have a surprising cool treat of the week.
Just you wait.
Just you wait. That'll be like clafouti. Oh, keep that in mind. That's happening a little bit.
C-L-A-F-O-U-T-I-S.
Oh,
clafouti.
Ooh, how nice. So, that's coming up. First, let's talk a bit about Iowa State Fair food. I mean, this is the week of Iowa State Fair.
This is a gigantic topic.
Yes.
A rich topic. A fattening topic.
And they always come out with new fancy foods each year to tempt the taste treats, and everybody gets their dollar bills out and slaps them down.
Yeah, and we have a secondhand report,
yes,
because Lana and I did not make it down. It's on all week, but the debut of the favorite food, fair food of the week is chocolate covered chunky maple bacon nougat on a stick.
On a stick.
So apparently it's some kind of ice creamy thing.
A candy bar sort of nougat. It says it's a candy bar
of your dreams.
Okay.
Available dipped in chocolate at the southwest side of the Livestock Pavilion. Well, the report I got was for $5, and it's not huge. It was so rich that she couldn't even finish it.
So that was one person's.
Yeah, yeah, and this person is not a wimp, okay? So we heard it's intense. You might buy one and share it with several friends.
Actually, it has a whole lot of good possibilities there. So all this maple, bacon, chocolate, it sounds like it'd be good. But all right.
It probably smells good, too, like a lot of other things at the fair.
I'm up for anything.
It's okay. The fair is only once a year. You know, it won't kill anybody.
Right. And actually, there's a Capri salad on a stick.
Yes, I heard there was an article in what is that, the Des Moines Register?
Yeah.
About this year's new fair foods, but there was an article somewhere about, quote, healthy foods at the fair. I'm sure it was a short list. And, of course, healthy is always a relative term.
Okay. That's good. But there's a lot of other stuff on a stick and zombie cones and, something else on a stick is the Rice Krispie treats called Fairberry Fair Square, a large fair square now adding, it doesn't say berries, it said it's added berryness. So kind of watch what that is. But it looks like a giant Rice Krispie bar on a stick and something called the Brownie Blitz. Brownies covered with whipped cream and stuff.
Oh, sounds like it might be related to our cold treat of the week.
Okay.
Our mystery cold treat of the week.
I knew I would get you. In between everything else, like my favorite is cotton candy, but I don't do that to myself every year. But I mean,
that's a deep childhood memory.
Yeah.
And that was we used to go to the county fair, and once a year we would be enchanted with the only one color. It was pink cotton candy, and it was wonderful because that was the only occasion ever that you could have it or see it. It wasn't like ubiquitous the way it is now. So of course it was more thrilling. Oh, and Lana, you told about how you could only eat it.
We could only eat it on the way out of the fairgrounds. And then we were sat in the back seat. Okay, hold your hands up. Don't touch anything on the way. We had a wonderful time at the fair.
I can remember, like, waving it in my sister's face and trying to, like, goop her up. And
you can goop up pretty easily.
My poor sister.
So, enjoy Iowa State Fair food. That's great. It's Iowa State Fair is going on all this week. I think the last day is the 16th. So,
well, it must be a good one this year because the weather is so reasonable.
Oh, yes. Yes, so. That's good. So Donna's been busy. She's been busy in the kitchen. And she's been whipping up cold soup. So why cold soup,
Donna? I have to blame this one on Lana because she said, oh, let's do cold soups next week. And so I decided I just kind of got tinkering, and I invited she and her partner Joe over for dinner on, what was it, Saturday night? And I said, when they got here, I said, gee, I hope you weren't expecting dinner. All I did was a bunch of experiments. So.
It was more than dinner because we tasted everything.
It was a tasting meal, as they say in the trade, but it wasn't, like, formatted and it didn't all go together. But there were three. We did four soups in a row, and we started with a cold bouillon soup, which traditionally is beef bouillon. Well, and Lana had not thought of cold bouillon soup. It's a very old, kind of Englishy thing. So I didn't make beef, but I did have some smoked chicken stock from a smoked chicken that I bought at the Story City Locker a few weeks ago. So I had that. So I just, you know, you pull the fat off the top. You want just the bouillon. And sometime we'll go into the whole way to make bouillon because there is a really old tradition on this one. But all I did was actually kind of get it out of the jar it had been refrigerated. And then it goes in a little, like, teacup, and it's kind of chunky. And
it's kind of jelly-like.
Yeah, it is.
It's a little thickening to it. And it's... I pretty much had to tell myself, okay, this is not cold bouillon, but I tasted it anyway, and it's really good.
Well, and you squirt a little lemon on it.
Ah.
And there is another thing. It's had a little revival lately of, what are they called? Beef shots, I believe, or something like that, where you take the beef bouillon in a shot glass with vodka, and you, whoop, down she goes.
Now, this is dessert, or this is an aperitif, or is
it
a starter?
It must be the beginning of something. I actually read a wedding where they eschewed champagne, and they did, bull shots it's called. It's called bull shots, right? And this is what they served to everybody. This was, it must have been a rough and tumble wedding, but bull shots. So, now, the other thing that I was doing while we were talking about the cold bouillon is I read a book, I finished it this week, called Minding the Manor, Memoirs of a 1930s English Kitchen Maid by Molly Moran, Moran. So she talks about starting as a scullery maid and working her way up to chief cook when there were only, like, coal fire ovens, no refrigeration was on ice. Everything came from the local farms and how they did it, you know, with no Cuisinarts and no this and no that. And, of course, bouillon was regularly served. And there is a technique, which I'm going to have to read more about it, but I'm going to try it sometime because I've read about it for years. But you actually clarify the beef stock by adding a whole raw egg with the shell into it. So I can't explain any more than that till I try it out, and then we'll give you a detailed culinary explication of the whole thing.
So stay tuned for that.
Yeah. And in the book, she described it as making the bouillon thick and velvety. So we'll have to see. So then the next soup that we had was a watermelon gazpacho.
Now, this is not your usual gazpacho. It was lovely.
This one I found on the internet because I was, you know, kind of tripping around going, oh, of course, the classic tomato cold soup is gazpacho. And I thought, well, you know, I kept reading. I did read about a strawberry gazpacho, but I thought, no, watermelon gazpacho is more appropriate because actually tomatoes and watermelons are in season at the same time.
There are tomatoes in this watermelon gazpacho?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
oh, yeah.
You tasted it.
Well, I know, but it was red. And watermelon's red and tomatoes are red.
Oh, right.
I just
oh.
wanted to clarify that.
Well, it's very simple. The recipe was, and I'm not writing this down, I want you to do it in the oral tradition. In the blender, right, seedless watermelon and tomatoes. Obviously, they have seeds in them. Okay, but you don't want watermelon seeds. Tomato seeds are okay. Slightly more watermelon than tomato. That's the main thing you have to remember. And then you put in, we forget, but of course, tomatoes are fruits. So paired with fruits, they're very nice.
Huh.
So the only other ingredients were salt, pepper, a little olive oil, not too heavy, celery. They called for celery. They said that's what brings it together. I did not have celery in the fridge, so I actually used lovage. But I think celery would work, and not a lot of it, but enough to give it a sort of vegetal flavor. And lemon juice.
It was lovely. It was red, so I was expecting gazpacho, but because of the watermelon, it was lighter.
It's less acidic. The watermelon actually does bring out the sweet side of the tomato. So I thought it was lighter. It didn't hit you as, oh, this is watermelon. It made it taste like, oh, this is a really good tomato, of which we've had a shortage so far this summer.
It was lovely. It was lovely.
It was good. And no basil, guys. No onions. Just, I believe I used lime, but it did say lemon, so I don't think it really matters. Just a bit of citrus and salt and pepper. So.
Okay, soup number three.
Soup number three. We were on a roll that night, let me tell you. Cucumber dill. This is really, really simple. And a lot of cold soups are like this. They're kind of like, non-breakfast smoothies, I would say. You know, you just plop them in the blender. You could use a food processor, but I think the blender gets a smoother texture. So I peeled a few cucumbers, of which we have had a very good cucumber year. People, didn't you say you've hardly had cucumber beetles? So
Right.
We're going to have an entomology report soon. I promise. It has been a very unusual year, but it has produced ubiquitous and wonderful cucumbers. So you peel them, unless they're the English variety, but you want to get the thick skin off, and you slit them down the middle and scoop the seeds out, put them in the blender. I put them in with yogurt, or one time I used my homemade kefir, and that's, you know, unflavored, plain yogurt, and fresh dill, a good hunk of fresh dill, salt and pepper, and zipped it up, and it was delicious. And Lana made one, too.
And very, very green. I'm a very visual person. After the rather mild-looking bouillon, and then we had this wonderful red, we were followed by a bright green dill. I made a dill cucumber soup with buttermilk, and I did add a small shallot to it.
So raw.
That had a little, and dill.
And that would be nice.
Had a little bit, just a
that
little
bit.
That
would be
in
very,
it.
Very
okay.
nice.
That
very
was
nice.
Good. So, soup number four.
Okay, this is the classic cold soup that everyone thinks about in very proper terms, vichyssoise, which is really nothing more than cold potato soup. And vichyssoise, in case you don't know, is spelled V-I-C-H-Y-S-S-O-I-S-E.
I had the dickens of a time trying to spell that. My computer kept saying, that's wrong, that's wrong. Of course it was wrong.
It's French.
Who would have thought? Vichyssoise. That's how to spell vichyssoise.
So I make it very simply. I just start a little pan, boil some potatoes. The classic way would be to peel the potatoes. I don't, however, because I'm a firm believer in potato skins and their value in one's diet. And so I throw in a couple of onions and the potatoes and cook them till they're extremely soft. And then I just puree them with the juice they've been cooked in. So don't put too much water in the pan. I puree them with either – now, this depends on your caloric needs or wishes. You can – put cream in it. You can put sour cream in it. You can put milk in it. Any of the above or combinations of them, and then salt and pepper, and then you know let it chill, and then and it should be, you know, not really really runny. It should be nice and thick,
You don't want it to be a blob, but you can also cook it in water or stock, as a matter of fact. Chicken stock is the classic. I used, once again, that smoked chicken stock, so it had a little bacony flavor to it, but it was really good. And then you serve it with chopped chives floating on the top.
That's a good use for chopped chives.
Yeah, I think we used garlic chives from the garden. But there you have it, your classic old-fashioned cold soup.
Cold soup. Lovely. So vichyssoise, cucumber dill, watermelon tomato, cold bouillon. Find yourself a blender and have
it. And it is so easy.
Right.
So easy.
You talked about how to serve these cold soups. It doesn't sound like you need much of these soups.
Well,
they sound very filling.
We were having different – well, I've done, for example, events where you serve shots – or a trio of cold soups is the first course in three little, like, espresso cups of different flavors. And usually when I did that, I tried to make them different colors so they would be attractive. Or sometimes past hors d'oeuvres are small shot glasses or tiny espresso teacups of soups because, you know, it's a flavor thing, one gulp. We did serve some of them in teacups, didn't we, Lana?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you kept bringing stuff out of your cupboard. It was lovely. Just now here's the next one. There were little taste treats all along. And like I said, for a woman that said, "Oh, we don't have anything for supper," it was just fine. Thank you.
Oh, I didn't say we didn't have anything. I said it wasn't like a. You know, usually when you make a meal, you sort of have a plan of a. Kind of a coherence of a this comes first and that comes next, and there's a relationship and a it's rather like it's an assemblage basically. And I didn't do any of that. I was just in the kitchen all day going, oh, and how does this taste and how does that work? And then I loaded it all off onto Joe and Lana. But the soups are good for a first course or even for a light supper. With, you know, some good bread and a little salad. It can be a whole meal, but it doesn't have to be a meal. I want to mention, because we didn't do this, but I was reading the New York Times had a recent article on cold soups, and they put bread in every single one of their recipes in the blender. And that is used as a thickener, kind of. But ours were thick enough because we used a lot of vegetables.
Oh, yes. I think bread would make it kind of like porridge.
Well, they probably used more either water or stock or something like that. And I'm against it, frankly. You know, why do we need bread in your soup?
I prefer our
recipes. So, folks, stick with us instead of the New York Times.
Yeah, that sounds good. Well, we have a question from a listener from last week's show. We're just off throwing out all this great information, and someone asked me, what is poaching? We talked about poached peaches last time.
Yeah, it was poached peaches poaching, what was the herb? Anise hyssop.
Right.
Riesling.
Right. So poaching isn't like something that Elmer Fudd does with a gun. No. No. Poaching is a kitchen thing, and Donna will tell us what poaching is.
Well, the clearest thing that would help you understand it is poached eggs. That's, you know, that's a childhood food. Everybody eats and still loves poached eggs. It's basically you get some hot water boiling, you drop the egg in it, so the egg is cooking in the water, right?
Okay.
So poaching is actually cooking something. It's not steaming.
And it's not boiling.
It's usually a slow simmer, you know, so you're not. Like, if you were poaching an egg and it were boiling too vigorously, the egg would not kind of stick together. It would become a little too rough and tumble, you know? So poaching is like a simmer, so it's gentle, and it's enough water that it's not just steaming.
So when you were talking about poaching peaches, does one put the whole peach in, or does one cut it in slices or halves? Or
In that particular recipe, he said, first you immersed them in boiling water and took them out to get the skin off. Now, that is not poaching. That's a whole different thing. Then in another pan, where you put the cooking liquid, which in this instance was Riesling wine and sugar and
anise
hyssop, right? Then you would lay the peeled peaches gently in the poaching water.
Cut in apart? Or?
Well, we talked about this, and
he didn't say.
No, he did say. He tried a trick that I'm not recommending. He found a way to inveigle the stone out of the middle of the peach and leave it in a whole sphere. Now, I'm sorry. I'm sure it would work if one were patient and tolerant. Me, I would just, and it has to be a freestone peach, not a cling, right? I would just run it halfway around the middle, pull it apart, and poach them in halves.
Yeah.
And then you can either serve them that way or you can slice them afterwards, but you would probably want to leave it in at least a half size.
Yeah.
So poaching is basically cooking in a liquid.
It's a gentle cooking.
Right. That's there are lots of other water cooking techniques, like a bain-marie, which is a hot water bath, which is different. That's like, for example, if you're cooking egg custard, you make the custards in the little ramekins, and then you put the ramekins in another pan and pour water till it comes, about two-thirds up the size of the ramekin. Mm-hmm. So they're actually cooking in the water, but they're not. Mm-hmm. The cooking thing, which is the custard in this instance, does not touch the water.
Yeah. Ramekins is a wonderful little word for a little round, straight-sided
custard cup. Exactly.
Yes,
exactly. Ramekin. And then the other thing that people cook with water is a double boiler. And we'll talk about that later. We're going to talk about curds.
Okay. We'll do that. All right. Good. Good. Let's take some food for our ears here. Some food for our ears. We're back. This is the Donalana Kitchen on KHOI Radio, community radio for the heart of Iowa. We've been talking about some cold summer things. I've got a herb of the week little item I want to share with you. I grew this herb this summer and then found out recently that it's kind of coming on the market or coming into the awareness of people who think, boy, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. It's called African basil.
Or African blue basil, some people call it. Yes.
Yes, or African blue basil.
So it's the same thing if you hear that name.
Yes. And it's becoming more and more available. So look for African basil or African blue basil. I heard that it was an accidental happy cross a couple years ago between a real African blue basil and a red opal basil. So it has a wonderful deep taste of a opal basil, but it has the hardiness of an African basil, and it has a trait that is probably really pretty good as we're moving into the winter months. And I found this to be so too. You can grow it indoors quite well. It's a very slow grower and it doesn't need a lot of light as compared to a lot of other basils. So I'll be watching my African basil and see if I can propagate it too. It's a lovely compact plant. You can keep it pinched back, and it does. I probably wouldn't make a whole lot of pesto out of it, although you could. It is a stronger, stronger sort of taste.
Yeah, I've grown it. I don't think it's great for pesto.
So do that in the summer and put that in your freezer.
Right.
But as a break it off and use it.
Mm-hmm.
You can have basil on your windowsill all year.
Now, and it does one other thing. Some people call it a perennial basil. Mm-hmm. It's not really a perennial, but it does self-seed.
Mm-hmm.
So it keeps going and going and going, and you don't have to replant it in the garden every year. That's a super plus in Iowa.
Right. I'll see if that works. I have some going to seed, but I'm also planning on taking it into the house.
So well, I did it in California, and it worked very well. You know, this is a whole different thing here, but I don't see why it wouldn't work.
We'll see what African basil
does
in this climate.
We'll report back next year
on this. Anyway, look for that African basil. It might be worth keeping around. Donna has some information about glyphosate.
Yeah, I want to be a bit of a downer here right now. You know, here in Iowa, we live bed of the belly of the beast, I like to call it, in terms of American agriculture. And because we grow a lot of corn and a lot of soybeans and some huge percentage of it is genetically modified to be glyphosate tolerant, which means they spray a lot of glyphosate around us. It's been talked about the possibility that, of course, this does cause birth defects and other alarming things. But I also read a new bit that was further disturbing. And this comes from a doctor who is Jeff Ritterman, vice president of the board of directors of the San Francisco Bay chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility. He is a retired cardiologist. He's a very credible guy. And he in this article, he's explaining not only the birth defects problem, but it seems that in addition, glyphosate is toxic to many of our gut bacteria, which he is saying leads to gastrointestinal maladies, kind of low-level chronic illnesses, elevated ammonia levels, sulfur deficiencies, and things like that. He also says the depletion of amino acids by glyphosate can result in abnormally low levels of neurotransmitter serotonin and dopamine. Now, when your serotonin and dopamine go down, this leads to depression, obesity, and anorexia, and of course, Parkinson's disease. So, he does warn us that glyphosate residues are not removed by washing. Cooking does not break down the glyphosate, and herbicide residue can remain in food for more than a year, even if the food is processed, dried, or frozen. So, it's clear that there's some problems here that have not been adequately looked at for the reasons that I won't get into because it's very, very political. But I just want you to know, all of you, to think about that, we are living with a lot of glyphosate in our air, in our water. It's certainly, not confined to the soil and doesn't just wash down the Mississippi River. So there's my bummer for the day.
Can you reference that website?
This story was, I read it on Truthout. It's an op-ed from Jeffrey Ritterman, MD. And he writes quite a lot about these things. We just have to be mindful that we're not living in a perfect world here. And even though Iowa looks gorgeous, it's a highly manufactured environment with a lot of toxicity around us. We're not sending it all to New Orleans.
And we are what we eat. Let's talk about
something more fun next, please.
Gooseberries.
Oh, yes. All right. Gooseberries are very cheerful. I got 3 quarts of them from Berry Patch, and they're really special to me. They were my mother's favorite. She always talked about having gooseberries, a whole hedgerow of gooseberries where she grew up. And for many years, it was very hard to find gooseberries in the last 20 or 30 years. And so finding gooseberries for me was a big treat. Now, these were pink gooseberries as opposed to the green varieties. They do come in lovely little sort of pastel-y colors. So I wanted to do something different with these gooseberries besides making a pie. which is traditional, or a jelly jam. And also, you know, gooseberries are little devils. They're hard to pick because they're in thorny, but I didn't pick them. Judy or somebody at Berry Patch picked them for me. But you still have to cut off both ends of the gooseberries, which is extremely tedious.
Yes, very fussy. They have little tails on them that are kind of tough.
So to solve part of this, because, I mean, 3 quarts is a lot of gooseberries, I decided to do a curd.
Oh, what is a curd?
A curd.
And this is with a C. C-U-R-D. Not K.
It's very English. So I found a recipe on the internet by Hugh Fernley Whittingstall, which is one of my favorite English chefs. And he called it curd instinct. Okay, very British humor. Anyway, curd is the lemon is the usual curd, okay? And it's sort of like, think of the filling of a lemon meringue pie. That is basically a curd. So it's a lot of egg yolks, sugar, some egg whites, and then a lot of butter, and then the lemon. So I wanted to do it with gooseberries. I also, in New Zealand, they sell it a lot, just in little jars. Either they call it lemon honey, but it is lemon curd. Or they do passion fruit curd, which I just gobble it up. I can't get enough. So I thought, okay, the gooseberry curd would be really delicious. And the easy part about it was you could cook the gooseberries down without having to pick the little ends off and then run them through the ricer. Mm-hmm. So you end up with kind of a gooseberry puree. And you put that in with the sugar over a double boiler.
Here we go with
a double boiler. So I don't own a double boiler. I just use a pot of water with a stainless steel bowl on top of it. And the only thing you have to remember is that the water level should not be touching the bottom of the pan.
Yeah. So it's a pan within a pan with some water
exactly.
in the bottom pan.
Exactly. And
the
steam is rising up, mm-hmm. and it's a good way so that you never burn things. Like when I make the hot fudge sauce or something mm-hmm. like that, you use a double boiler like that. So with the curd, you just mix the gooseberries and the sugar, and you get it. You have to mix it enough with a whisk until the sugar is all dissolved. Then you stir in. And you know what? I will try to write this recipe up so that it's on the website, because it's some whole eggs and some you in a separate bowl, you beat the eggs with extra yolks till they're all kind of homogeneous. And then you have to put, this is the thing with putting eggs into things, you know, you have to put a little of the hot into the eggs so you and keep beating it so they don't like cook all at once. So right. you keep adding a little of the hot to the eggs and stirring and a little more hot and a little more hot. And when you think you've maybe put half of the hot mixture into the cold eggs, then you can put the whole thing back into the double boiler and mix it all up. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She'll write this
yeah.
down.
Yeah. And then you start throwing in little bits of butter. And you turn it off at that point because you've cooked until it gets nice and thick and creamy from the eggs and the sugar and the berries. And my recipe also had lemon juice in it. Although, I must say, we probably could have done without the lemon juice because the berries are quite tart. Gooseberries are very tart. Yes, I did whisk and whisk and whisk. You have to keep moving. Keep it moving the whole time. And then you keep dropping in bits of butter. Now, I'm going to ask Lana what she thinks of it afterwards because she got a jar of it. I had some butter in the freezer that had rose geranium infused, okay? And this was from a further culinary accident, right? I was making, I was working with some other people and we were making the rose geranium whipped cream where you infuse the cream with the geranium and then cool it off and strain it off. And this person over whipped it and it turned into butter. So I said, oops, well, but don't throw it away. I will save it and use it for cooking. So I got the rose geranium butter out, and I used it in this curd. So
a fortuitous accident.
Yes, and probably never to be replicated. But anyway, it was good. But plain butter is just fine. And the amount of butter can vary largely, depending on how rich you want it. Since I had the rose geranium, I really gilded the lily there. And so, Lana, what did you think of it?
Oh, it's lovely. It's so wonderfully rich. It's more than pudding. It's kind of like frosting pudding ice cream, not cold. It's really good and it's lovely.
And how are you eating?
Well, you told me to put it on toast, of which I did.
That's my favorite.
But I think
it's so
I
easy.
Think I'm going to make a real simple cake. Just a simple cake.
Oh, and put it as a layer in between.
It in a layer.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
It's just really nice.
It's delicious. And my friend Lou just mixed it right into some yogurt. Oh,
well, you could do that too. Sounds good. And so now we're moving on to the big thing that we introduced to start out with. What is a clafouti?
Ah, the clafouti. Okay, this is where the rest of the gooseberries went. I did hand pick through a bunch of them and cut both ends off. I used a little scissors. I was working away at it, and I'd had just the right amount, and I was sitting in a chair, and I knocked over the bowl of gooseberries. And, of course, they rolled all over the kitchen floor, all through the dog hairs and the whole thing. I was so frustrated because I had worked so hard. So I picked every single one of them up, put my glasses on, and rinsed all the dog hairs off.
Oh.
But clafouti is...
Those things do happen.
Oh,
and
I
would do that, too, because gooseberries are our treat. So.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't going to waste all those gooseberries after I had done that. So a clafouti is... it's a southern or Provence. It's a south of France kind of dessert that's very, very easy to make. Otherwise, we wouldn't be bothered telling you this, right? But it's traditionally kind of cake like. It's eggs, milk, and flour and fruit. I'm gonna give you a basic clafouti recipe here.
It looks like a really small sort of a sweet quiche sort of thing.
Yes, it is kind of. That's a good comparison.
But it's fruit infused. And so it's this little puddingy, quiche-y, sweet.
Yeah,
it's,
I think
it's good.
The kind of basic clafouti is made with plums. However, you can do it with cherries. You can, and people also cook them with the pits in it sometimes because the pit also gives flavor, you know, and if you're expecting a pit, you don't break your tooth on it. Basically, I use a pie pan. I set the oven. I think I put it at 325. And what did I put on the, I buttered the pie pan just lightly. And I sprinkled a little sugar on it. And then, you know, did that the way you would with flouring a pan. Shook the excess off. And then in a bowl, you mix, this recipe has a cup of whole milk. Now you can use cream or cream and milk. And 3 eggs and a half a cup of sugar, vanilla extract, and 2 tablespoons of butter melted. Now, if you use cream, you don't have to use the butter. And a half a cup of flour. So you just mix all of those things together, pour them into the pan, and then your fruit, whatever it is. In this case, I had taken the gooseberries, and I had kind of crunched them up until they were a little bit juicy. And I think I put some orange zest in them and maybe a little ground coriander. I just, you know, I've lightly flavored them with more sugar because gooseberries are very tart. So, and then I kind of drop that all over the top of the egg and flour mixture. You put it in the oven and it just kind of puffs right up and cooks. And some people like to eat it fresh out of the oven when it's hot. I like to actually chill it and let it settle down a little bit. So you kind of get this eggy, slightly custardy, but you know, there's no crust, no fuss, no muss. You just kind of mix a bunch of liquid and flour up, throw it in the pan, add the fruit, stick it in the oven, bing, bang, bong.
Besides having a wonderful thing to call it, a clafouti.
Clafouti.
Yes, that's it. Wonderful. And then, after I tasted this clafouti thing, which I love to be able to say that, you did another cool treat of the week.
Oh, this one. I have been reading about these, you know, I read a lot of culinary websites and see what's going on and da-da-da-da-da. And what kept popping up, and we have mentioned it before, is the root beer float. I mean, the beer float, not the root beer float, the beer float, okay? So I finally said, well, I think we're going to have to.
We should try this.
Just jump in because it's so simple. Why not? You know.
We had to try this so we could report on it. So here goes.
Okay, I found actually a good bit of writing about it that says very sensible things. It says when picking a beer and ice cream, start with classic combinations: a thick chocolate stout, and creamy vanilla ice cream are a no-fail pairing. It doesn't matter if the ice cream is homemade or store-bought. For something fruit-forward, start with a German Hefeweizen or Belgian Saison. The light floral notes of these beers intensify when combined with strawberry ice cream or berry sorbet. So it also says, like coffee, double up on caffeinated bliss. Think of this as the Affogato's heavy set drunk cousin. Simply pair Imperial Coffee Stout with your favorite coffee-flavored ice cream. I should mention here what affogato is. Have we talked about affogato?
No.
Okay. This is what you would have for breakfast, and the root beer float would come, or the beer float would come later. So affogato is when you take a shot of espresso and you pour it over vanilla ice cream.
Oh, I can see that.
It's so good.
Nice.
It's so good.
Nice way to start the day.
Yeah, yeah. So this is they were comparing this to an affogato. So here's what we did. It also says whichever pairing you decide on, pour your brew carefully to make sure it gets a nice foamy head for the ice cream to swim in. So pour the beer in the glass first and plop the ice cream on top. So what we did was I got an organic chocolate stout. I thought, let's go with the simple chocolate on chocolate. And we put chocolate ice cream in it. And I know it sounds a little weird. It sounds even a little rude and disgusting. But OMG, this might be my new favorite treat. What do you think, Lana?
So cool treat of the week. It was great, believe it or not. It was just lovely.
It's hysterical because it's so good and
yes.
So unexpected. You know, I keep telling people about it and they go, oh, yuck, I don't think so. And I thought, well, tasting is believing.
And in the spirit of adventure.
Yes, right. We sacrificed for
we
you guys.
We jumped in.
We did.
And this was really good.
And we are recommending it.
So, cool treat of the week, a beer float and chocolate on chocolate. Try that or other combinations.
Yes, I think I'm going to have to try the strawberry one next.
Oh, that sounds good. You're listening to Donalana Kitchen on KHOI Community Radio. Support KHOI and send your thoughts to KHOI to khoiradio@gmail.com. Also, we'll be listening to some more music here. We're back. This is the Donalana Kitchen on KHOI Radio. You've been enjoying the music by Scottish fiddler Elka Baker. She's a great fiddler. I've had the pleasure of dancing to that woman, and I've had the pleasure of calling dances to that woman. It's good. It's from one of her CDs called Glenegg, which is actually a place name in Scotland, Glenegg. It's Elka Baker, that's it. So, what exactly is a ground cherry? What is a ground cherry anyway? I'll talk a little bit about ground cherries. A ground cherry is no relation to a cherry, actually. A ground cherry is related to the tomato. It's a member of the nightshade family. I found out about, well, I knew about ground cherries because it's something my family did, grandmothers and things did have ground cherries. They're a little low-growing bush that have these little husk tomatoes on them.
Oh, right. They have the little papery thing, little skins papery around them like a tomatillo.
Like a tomatillo, but mm-hmm. they're smaller. But and they turn orange. If you pick them green, they're rather uninteresting. You let them ripen until they're orange.
Don't they come in colors, too? Are there yellow ones?
Well, they go through various phases.
Ah.
So they go yellow, orange, whatever. But they're the best when they're orange. I found out more about ground cherries, and I learned how to make ground cherry jam from one of my heroes. Do you remember Yul Gibbons? He was around in the 70s, and he was on Johnny Carson every now and then. Probably one of the first popular foragers in the country.
Stalking the Wild Asparagus.
Stalking the Wild Asparagus is the name of his book. He's written other ones, too. He ate pretty much anything he could find. One thing about ground cherries is that they're pretty easy to find. Not easy to find, but they're in many, many different climates. In this country, ground cherries are most often found in cultivated or fallow fields and sometimes in burned over areas. They're quite easy to find in a prairie. So guess what? You can find them in the prairie. However, now, Yul Gibbons was good at being able to forage these things, but if you go out in the prairie and try to find them,
I don't think I've seen any to pick wild.
They're kind of few and far between. You'd find one plant, and you need lots of them to make jam. So luckily,
this is like mushroom hunting, I
think.
Right,
it is. But you're out in the sunshine because it's a tomato-related plant. So you need lots of them to make jam. So I've taken to growing them. You can find them in seed catalogs. They're called ground cherries. They're also called Cape gooseberries.
Oh, Cape gooseberries. Now, they're not related to gooseberries, but you will read about a Cape gooseberry.
He says they're also called a bladder cherry. That doesn't sound good at all.
That sounds very Native American
or something. Or a strawberry tomato. But you can find them, ground cherries, in seed catalogs. I like the variety called Aunt Molly's. I don't know why. And they grow like tomatoes. I start them early, so I have all my tomatoes in the same place. They do, or all my ground cherries in the same place.
They ripen it at the same time as tomatoes.
Right. Yeah. They do self-seed, but by the time, I like to get a jump on things with ground cherries because they keep producing over a long time, so that's
in
good.
From now until
middle of September, yes. Here is Yul Gibbons' recipe for ground cherry jam. To make jam, crush 1 quart of husked ground cherries and add the juice of 2 lemons and the grated peel of 1 lemon, 1/2 cup water, and 1 package of powdered pectin. Boil for 5 minutes and add 4 cups of sugar. Boil hard for a minute or two or until you get a jelly test. You can look into some. We'll talk about jelly tests on a future show. And then you pour into half-pint jars and seal immediately. He also talks about a plant like this that is very, very popular in Hawaii, of all places. And it's called poa there. Poa.
Spell that.
P-O-H-A. Poa. Mm-hmm. And they make a poa preserve. Same sort of thing. Cook it down. But they keep it as kind of sticky, sweet, ungelled sort of thing.
So you just don't add the pectin.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then they also have some make a poa pie. Once you've tasted ground cherries, which I think tastes like sort of a combination of apricots and pineapples kind of thing.
I hope you mean that you've actually made some of this in the last few weeks.
Yes, I have.
Oh, yummy,
yes.
Yummy.
My first little batch came in. I'm not exactly swimming in them, but I do have some. But the last line of Yul Gibbons' advice about ground cherries is, I'm sure you'll be able to use up all the ground cherries you can find. If there are any left over, call me.
Yeah, they're scarce, I would say, probably.
Yes, yes. There's some fun stuff coming up. I want to mention Seed Savers Workshop on Mustard Seed Farm is happening Saturday, August 16th, 1 to 4 p.m. on Mustard Seed Community Farm, and you can call 515-460-1467.
And be sure to call them because otherwise you'll never find it.
No, it's kind of a northwest out of town and
not that far out of Ames.
Call that number and you will find it. Donna, you have now, something.
Yes. Ta-da! The big weekend is coming where we are having the Booze and Blues Festival at De La Vida Wine Shop on Main Street. It's at 5 o'clock on Sunday. It is a fundraiser for KHOI. So Lana and I will be there. Also, Scott Coldiron from Vesuvius is hauling in his wood-fired mobile oven, and we will be serving hors d'oeuvres of wood-fired pizza. And I'll be manning the food station with Scott. Come on down. The music will be curated by Gildy, our wonderful one of our DJs. And
good music. And there will be a silent auction with all sorts of fun stuff. So support your local radio station.
5 o'clock Sunday evening, De La Vida on Main Street.
So join us there. Come on down and say hello. Also, for more information on KHOI and the events coming up this week, this weekend, go to khoifm.org. For information on the radio conference, which is also this week, the grassroots radio conference, go to grc2014.net. Okay? You can also find the Donalana Kitchen on the KHOI website. Go there and find archives of past shows, recipes, find a great picture of Donna and I will be there.
Yeah, you can listen. And if you didn't catch all the details and you want to listen to the show again, it's archived. So you just go. Well, I won't say it doesn't get archived immediately, but within a week or so,
We'll get around to it. It will be there. Yes. So you can find us at noon on Tuesdays, and this show is repeated 7 o'clock in the evening. We'll go out with some more music from Elka Baker. We're starting out with some contra tunes here, and this contra dance tunes. This one's called Robert's Unreal. This has been the Donalana Kitchen with Lana Noctigal.
And Donna Prisgintas.
With excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. Eat good food and enjoy life.